The headlines, confrontation in the Sea of Oman. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps stopping U.S. forces from stealing Iranian crude oil. A Republican winning the race for governor in the U.S. state of Virginia and a setback for President Biden ahead of next year's congressional elections. Whilst Russia is still struggling to contain the spiraling COVID infections, the country records its highest fatalities in a single day. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Iran said has blocked U.S. forces from stealing a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps will soon be releasing footage of the incident. Tehran says U.S. forces attempted to seize a tanker that was carrying Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The IRGC's naval forces proceeded to capture the tanker, carrying out a heliborne operation, and led the vessel toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then started chasing the tanker using helicopters and warships, but all their attempts to block the tanker's path or seize it have failed. The tanker is now in Iran's waters. America has a history of creating instability in Iran's southern waters. We've spoken with political commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh. He tells us that the attempt by U.S. forces to steal a shipment of Iranian oil is a move meant to bring Tehran back to the negotiating table in Vienna and pressure it to give in to Washington's demands. Let's listen.
This is an American invasion, a hostile action against Iranian interests. This would definitely escalate the tensions. But the purpose of such moves is very much clear, as Iran has been practicing resistance diplomacy to resist against the United States pressures, illegal sanctions, and forces to get Tehran back to the nuclear talks, the Vienna talks, the way the U.S. desires, in order to push Tehran to consent to the U.S. demands. Well, they escalated the tensions, both the United States and its proxy Israeli regime. They escalated the tensions against Tehran all throughout the region. They resorted to cyber attack on Iranian oil palms just a few weeks ago. They also escalated the tensions through sabotage attacks, terrorist attacks, and through sabotaging or efforts to sabotage Tehran's relations with some regional states. But after Tehran reiterated that it would get back to the Vienna talks soon, though resistance diplomacy is in place, it would not agree to the U.S., the concessions that the U.S. has demanded. They are pressuring Tehran on the threshold of the resumption of the talks in Vienna in order to force Tehran to agree to their, to the merits that they are demanding.
Multiple elections have been held in the United States with Republican candidates taking the lead in the gubernatorial race in some key states. The Republican wins signaled trouble for Joe Biden's presidency ahead of next year's midterm elections, especially in light of his growing unpopularity. Let's have a closer look.
November 2nd was a landmark day in U.S. politics. Several elections were held, including the race for governor in Virginia and New Jersey, and mayoral polls in cities like New York, Atlanta, Boston, and Pittsburgh. In Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin has garnered enough votes to win the battle against his Democratic rival Terry McAuliffe. To win over voters during a campaign speech in Chantilly, Youngkin said he will work to improve the living standards of his fellow citizens, a promise that would strike a chord with many people.
We are going to keep our communities safe. We're going to comprehensively fund law enforcement because they stand up for us, and we are going to stand up for them.
Another Republican victory was registered in New Jersey, where Jack Citarelli took a lead over incumbent Democratic rival Governor Phil Murphy. Mayoral races were also held in several cities, including New York City. There, Eric Adam, a Democrat, managed to win the highly contested vote. Virginia's gubernatorial race is traditionally viewed as a crucial barometer of the president's national standing That takes on added importance against the backdrop of the latest polls indicating a drop in Biden's approval rating, the lowest level of his presidency. The president's loss of support, driven by his much-criticized messy pullout from Afghanistan and the Americans' economic concerns, is seen by many as the cause of the Republican resurgence in these elections.
Let's take a look at what's been happening. We've had failures in Afghanistan when there was an attack where several service members were killed. We still have an economy that's still not up and running the way that people would like. We have issues when it comes to his infrastructure bill. It seems that pieces of the infrastructure bill keep getting taken out. And a lot of people are wondering what is going on with the promises coming from the Biden administration.
With Republicans winning in Virginia and New Jersey, the control of Congress and the fate of President Biden's agenda will be at stake. Many see the GOP wins in the gubernatorial race as not only a loss for Biden, but also a blow to the whole Democratic Party and the run-up to the next year's midterm vote.
So the fact that Youngkin will be the governor, likely the governor of Virginia, won over so many independent voters is mind-blowing. But in a lot of ways, it's also not, because Biden has failed, the Democrats have failed the people of Virginia, what's called the Rust Belt. And so they're looking for an alternative. I don't believe that the Republicans are the proper alternative. But it's still expressing the will of the people that they're not satisfied with the Democrats.
The United States has been grappling with a whole host of issues, including economy ahead of education, taxes, and the COVID pandemic. Racial injustice and rising consumer prices are among other public concerns. But with the failure of the Biden administration to address those issues, it is highly likely that the 2024 presidential race will be a tight one.
Palestinian families are turning down an Israeli proposed deal on their homes in a neighborhood in Al-Quds, saying the offer is only meant to justify occupation at their expense.
We rejected the compromise offered to us by the court of the occupation, which considers us as protected tenants renting from the settlers' organization and which will lead to the confiscation of our wife in our lands. We reject because we believe in our cause and our right to our home and country, despite that we're not getting any guarantees to support our steadfastness as Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem from any side or organization.
Israel has for months been seeking to evict four Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and give their land to settlers. The families say the deal is unjust because it's meant to force them into recognizing the settlers' ownership of their lands. Hamas says rejecting the deal is the right decision to make, and that by doing so, these families are avoiding the political traps set by Israel. Hamas is asking all Palestinians to support them. Israel's Supreme Court has proposed that the Palestinian families remain in their homes for 15 years in exchange for rent. They were given until November the 2nd to make their decision. A Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, says the Israeli decision to evict Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah will likely ignite new clashes between local residents and the Israeli settlers. Let's listen in.
They are now urging the international community to intervene. They are saying that the Palestinians across the occupied territories in Al-Quds should stand with them, and this is what's going on. Palestinians are saying that the Israeli court's decision is illegal, and they support the Palestinian families, and they will continue to protect them to remain in their homes. But the fear is now that this refusal, the family's refusal of the Israeli decision might cause the clashes between other settlers living in illegally living in their homes inside the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. But up to the moment, the Palestinian families made their decision clear. They will not leave their homes, and they will not accept the Israeli court's decision to pay rent for settler groups for 15 years, because after 15 years, this means that they will be forced to leave their homes, and that the Israeli regime will confiscate the land and the homes and bring settlers to illegally live instead of them.
It's been 104 years since British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his infamous declaration giving Israeli settlers the permission to usurp Palestinian land. Asher Shannon has more in this following report.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then-British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for their pain and suffering for more than 7 decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Israeli military targeting the Damascus countryside with a second missile strike in just a few days. The airstrike was launched from the northern parts of the occupied Palestine earlier Wednesday. Syrian media are quoting military sources as saying that the strike targeted a post in the Zakiya neighborhood near Damascus. The attack has caused some material damage. No word on possible casualties. Just days ago, Syrian air defenses intercepted Israeli surface-to-surface missiles over the same area. 2 soldiers were injured in that attack. Israel frequently launches missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has been demanding action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military sites as well as resistance fighters battling terrorists. UN Rights Chief is concerned about the extreme brutality of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region, warning of, quote, possible crimes against humanity by all sides.
We have reasonable grounds to believe that during this period, all parties to the Tigray conflict have committed violations of international human rights, humanitarian, and refugee law. Some of these may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
The UN office has conducted a joint investigation with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. Bachelet wants perpetrators from all sides to face justice. The northern region of Tigray has witnessed heavy fighting between government troops and rebels for nearly a year now. Thousands of people have lost their lives and millions have been displaced since then. The government is now enforcing a nationwide state of emergency amid fears that Tigrayan rebels are heading for the capital, Addis Ababa. Political commentator Lawrence Freeman says U.S. support for rebels in Tigray instead of the Ethiopian government has prolonged insecurity in the country.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is acting to overthrow the government of the duly elected Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, and has been tacitly supported by the West. If not for the attacks by the U.S. government and Biden administration on the Prime Minister in Ethiopia and tacit support for TPLF, this effort by the Tigrayan insurrectionists would have died off months and months ago. And therefore, the correct policy should be for the United States, instead of threatening more sanctions, should be to support the nation state of Ethiopia. And that's what all nations and all people of goodwill should be doing. If Ethiopia breaks apart or begins to break apart, this would be a disaster for the Horn of Africa, but also for the rest of the world, because it would heighten the insecurity problem in Africa.
The UK says its stance on the fishing route with France has not changed despite a relative easing of tensions between the two neighbors. Speaking to reporters in Glasgow, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson dismissed the feud as, quote, vanishingly unimportant. Paris and London are in talks to resolve the fishing dispute. On Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron delayed sanctions against the UK. Paris threatened London with restrictions last week after Britain insisted on barring French fishermen from British waters. London argues that the fishermen lack sufficient paperwork, but France accuses Britain of breaching a post-Brexit trading arrangement regarding fishing rights. Well, the rift deepening between France and Australia over a collapsed submarine deal, Paris is now accusing Canberra of deliberately deceiving the French by abandoning the deal.
The deceit was intentional, and because there was far more at stake than providing submarines, because it was a common agreement on sovereignty, sealed with the transmission of highly classified data, the way it was handled was plainly a stab in the back.
The French ambassador also questioned Australia's commitment to its partners, saying the way it acted was not befitting friends. The envoy was addressing the National Press Club after returning to Canberra. He was recalled to Paris in September over the spat. The Australian Prime Minister was quick to dismiss the accusation. Scott Morrison's stance has been that the deal did not serve Canberra's strategic interests. Australia terminated the $90 billion submarine contract with France and instead opted for a trilateral security partnership with the United States and Britain. Paris was angered by the move and later recalled its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. And Russia's daily COVID toll hitting another record high as the new wave of the pandemic seems to be nowhere near subsiding. Nearly 1,200 people losing their lives to the virus in the past 24 hours. That's the 15th consecutive day the country is seeing over 1,000 fatalities. The total tally is now above 242,000. There have also been over 40,000 daily infections. The overall caseload is above 8.6 million. Russian officials are struggling to contain the surge, reimposing a partial lockdown nationwide. Elsewhere in Europe, the Czech Republic is recording its highest daily infections since March, with around 10,000 cases. Also, Poland's daily cases top 10,000 for the first time since April. Well, that's a wrap for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei. in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
There is another quotation from the Commander of the Faithful, alayhi salam, in his decree to Malik Ashtar. He says, avoid showing the existence of obligation on your subjects for having done good to them or praising your own actions. First of all, you should not think that the people are obliged to thank you for what you have done. And secondly, you should not exaggerate about what you have done, or making promises and then breaking them. This means making promises and then failing to honor them. Imam Ali alayhi salam warns Malik Ashtar not to act like this. And this is a very important point. Of course, then sometimes you make a promise, but later on you see that there is no possibility to fulfill it. For example, there might be a natural problem. It is all right. You should explain this to the people, saying that although you made this promise, a certain problem arose which prevented you from fulfilling it, and ask for their forgiveness. This is another case of speaking to the people. This is another example of popularity, as explained before.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, generally speaking, you should be careful about the promises that you make. You should impose a deadline for your promises. You should estimate the time that it will take to carry out a task and set a deadline for it, and then you must follow it meticulously. I have said many times among executive officials that we have no shortage of rules and regulations. We have an abundance of laws, projects, and rules and regulations. What we lack is serious follow-up. This is another point. It is very important for the administration to have solidarity, power, and mastery. The solidarity of the administration means that executive officials should not say contradictory things. If one official says something and another says the opposite thing, the people's minds and public opinion will change unfavorably. There should be solidarity both in words and action. The affairs of a sector might be interrelated with many other sectors. Your agricultural sector is naturally connected with a few other sectors. There should be cooperation so that the task in hand will be accomplished properly.
In Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the World War II was dragging on, the United States tested the first ever nuclear bomb in a desert in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. The test, codenamed Trinity, plunged humanity into the so-called Atomic Age. The US holds another record as well. They are the first nation to ever use an atomic weapon in combat. On August 6, 1945, the US dropped the world's first deployed atomic bomb over the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The explosion instantly killed an estimated 80,000 people, while tens of thousands lost their lives later due to the radiation exposure. 3 days later, a second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, killing an estimated 40,000 people there. In fact, the US is the only country in history to have cold-bloodedly used this particular sort of weapon of mass destruction ever. Not once, but twice. The world's nuclear-armed states possess a combined total of approximately 13,000 nuclear warheads. The US, along with Russia, own over 90% of the world's total nuclear arsenal. Washington and Moscow signed the Non-Proliferation Agreement of New START on 8th of April 2010 in Prague, and later extended it for 5 years in January 2021. The treaty caps each country at 1,550 strategic deployed warheads. Today, the United States deploys over 1,300 strategic warheads on several hundred bombers and missiles. It is also estimated to have approximately 3,800 stockpiled warheads and 1,750 retired warheads awaiting dismantlement, for a total of 5,550 warheads as of early 2021. While Washington may have reduced its nuclear arsenal in size, in fact, it's increasing the destructiveness of its weapons by development of sophisticated electronic sensors and fuses at the cost of billions of dollars to have more advanced nuclear warheads. The US has time and again stated that it is committed to the New START Treaty until Russia is. However, it seems Washington is not completely committed to the agreement. On one hand, it is reducing the number of its nuclear warheads. On the other, it produces more lethal, destructive bombs with higher precision. The US is expected to release its latest nuclear posture review by the end of this year. US allies are concerned over a proposed change to Washington's long-standing policy on using nuclear weapons. The US is reportedly considering putting a limit on the use of nuclear weapons, such as announcing a no first use of nuclear weapons or declaration of a sole purpose. That means Washington will only use nuclear weapons to respond to nuclear attacks. Hence, the US allies, including the UK, Germany, France, Japan, and Australia, are reportedly lobbying the Joe Biden administration to not to abandon the policy of a strategic ambiguity on using nuclear weapons. They believe this decision will make them more prone to possible threats from China and Russia. Obviously, this shows the anti-nuclear doctrine the US allies have been advocating is totally deceitful. They are simply pursuing unilateral nuclear security as they want to expand their own right to use nuclear weapons. But they have tried every possible means to take away the right of using nuclear power from other countries, such as Iran. Restrictions on using nuclear weapons create constructive opportunities for global security. But does Biden have the courage to take real steps to do so? The group was formed to address major issues related to global economy. It is composed of world's largest economies, including Brazil, Britain, China, Germany, India, and the US, among others. These member countries account for 80% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the world population. But the G20 has been criticized for its limited membership, particularly for its underrepresentation of African countries. There are also disputes over the legitimacy of the G20 and criticisms of its organization and its declarations. The group has failed to address its previous promises, like inequality, social justice, poverty, capitalism, and unemployment. Therefore, the summits are often met with protests, especially by anti-globalization groups. This year, the G20 annual summit gathered the international leaders of world's biggest economies for a two-day meeting under the chairmanship of Italy in Rome. The summit was the first in-person meeting in over a year after the 2020 summit was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Still, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in the summit virtually. The member states addressed several global challenges, such as the pandemic, climate change, spiking energy prices, supply chain disruptions, and so forth. The bloc is under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. These nations account for roughly 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. This year's event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. In fact, wealthy nations such as the US have implemented a Me First policy by stockpiling vaccine doses and offering booster shots, while many poor countries are still waiting to receive their first COVID jabs.
Well, they have failed to end inequality, to end poverty, and to slow and change the trajectory of climate change, because the leaders of these governments simply don't care about those things.
After Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have urged Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, US President Joe Biden, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have called on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but started cutting back on them in response to the US abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November, but wants to see the verifiable removal of sanctions as an outcome of the talks. Washington, on the other hand, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions on Friday, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement.
They will justify it by saying that Iran wouldn't come back to the bargaining table. They will not look at the fact that it was the United States that withdrew, and the United States that must make the first major moves to resurrect this agreement. But this summit is certainly a place where many, many discussions occur. Many issues are on the table to be resolved. The situation with U.S. violations of the JCPOA is certainly one of them, but it is being ignored.
Iran has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. Meanwhile, Tehran has time and again stated that its nuclear program is peaceful, and it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran's stance is clear: effective removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the normalization of economic and trade ties with the country. Iran requires guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not break their promises once again.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced the dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued, but that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Khordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is, if any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world. So they really don't understand criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Khordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, the Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, urged his companions to treat people according to the rules of social conduct. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, asked his companions to meet people with cheerfulness and good words. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Good words and cheerfulness lead to love and nearness to Allah. Bad words and frowning lead to hate and remoteness from Allah." Mm-hmm.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When discussing the different dialogues that Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam had, we find an interesting conversation between one of Imam Al-Baqir's companions and Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam. And so in this conversation, the companion asks Imam Al-Baqir, interestingly, about the qualities of a companion, and a good companion at that. We find that Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam replied to his companion that, "I had a companion. The companion regarded the world as small. Thus, I regarded him as great." And then so in this beautiful dialogue, we find, even though Imam Al-Baqir probably said just two or three sentences, these two or three sentences have a whole world of meaning and ideology. So what kind of companion did Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam consider to be great, to be esteemed, to be auspicious, to be honored? Well, that companion is the companion who regarded the world as small. Now here we're not talking about the physical world being physically small. Rather, we're talking about the world in Arabic it is known as ad-dunya, dunya, the world. And this world is a metaphor for the materialistic wealth and the materialistic things and the materiality of the world. So we're talking about the different deceptions that the world tries to seduce and entice humanity towards, whether it's wealth or power or status or fame or glory, and things along these lines. And so Imam Al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, very eloquently says that the companion is great, the one who regards the world as small. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam Al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam Al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. The way he was able to influence the masses, I very briefly put it out, but I want to elaborate on that a little more. The methodology that Imam Al-Baqir presented to the Muslim Ummah that affected and influenced and was able to preserve and bring closer to the track and tracks of the Holy Prophet, what he laid down as the tracks for believers, the path, the true path, Sirat al-Mustaqim. This methodology was something that brought everyone closer to that path. The similarities are that we have come to a condition, brothers and sisters, whether it's in the wider Muslim community or particularly within the Shia community, We have come to a point where, on a mass scale, the average believer, the Muslim that we have, especially I want to talk about the Muslims in the Western countries, the movement of Islam, the work of the ulama of Islam, the impact of it on the Muslims living in Muslim lands, that's something that needs to be discussed at a different time. The conditions that we are facing here in the Western world particularly, which is what I'm more familiar with. In non-Muslim lands, there's different areas, and I'm not familiar with all of them. I'm more familiar with what's happening in the West. And what I see is very similar in to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Snipers belonging to the Lebanese Forces Militia opened fire at a peaceful protest led by Hezbollah and Amal protesters. In the mainstream media, they've called them clashes. Many Lebanese accuse them of purposely hiding or obfuscating the identities of the victims and even of blaming Hezbollah for the violence. So were these just clashes, as some in the media have suggested, or something more sinister aimed at provoking a reaction from Hezbollah, an escalation and dragging Lebanon into a civil war? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. October 14th, seven people were martyred and dozens more wounded after snipers opened fire at protesters in Beirut's Tayuna district. The majority of the victims, supporters of Hezbollah and its ally, the Amal movement, who'd gathered outside the Palace of Justice. Intended as a peaceful, unarmed protest, Hezbollah called for the demonstration the day before to protest against a judge named Tariq Bitar, who people accuse of politicizing the investigation into the Beirut port explosion. Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar reported that the American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, was attempting to frame Hezbollah for the explosion and influence the investigation. As protesters gathered outside the Palace of Justice, sniper fire began to erupt as gunmen on the surrounding buildings began firing at the protesters from rooftops and other vantage points. After the violence erupted, the armed wings of these groups then arrived with weapons to defend the protesters. And I think this is a very important point to understand, because some people in the Western mainstream media and Lebanese media have referred to the massacre as a clash, implying an exchange of fire between two sides. But is that really how things went down? Because when snipers start shooting at protesters, that's an ambush. It's an attack. It's not a clash, which would require both sides to be fighting from the start. Now, some people have also posted videos online saying, look, you see, the protesters were armed. Hezbollah and Amal, they brought weapons to the protest. They asked for it. But this is, again, untrue. One of the martyrs was a mother waiting at the window for her children to come home from school. She wasn't even at the protest, let alone carrying